Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on June 26, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. My usual co-host, Frank Pasquale, is traveling this week, but I am very happy to be joined by Wendy Mariner, professor of law and the Edward R. Utley Professor of Health Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights at Boston University. Welcome, Wendy.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I think everyone has a pretty good sense of what happened on Thursday. Let me start by asking you for your sort of overall reaction to the case and maybe what you thought were its most important facets.
Well, I know everyone breathed a huge sigh of relief, at least in the White House and in the households that get federal subsidies to buy their insurance. But from the lawyer's point of view, I think that the key to this decision is really the court's determination to take responsibility for interpreting the ACA text itself. We all know now that it means that even under a future administration, the IRS could not redefine the meaning of those words established, an exchange established by a state. But even though the court agreed with the IRS determination of an interpretation of the phrase, the court found that the interpretation was not the prerogative of the IRS, right? It said, at least the majority, that Congress did not delegate interpretive authority to the IRS on this, and I quote, this question of deep economic and political significance that is central to this statutory scheme, close quote. In other words, the court said it was the court's responsibility to determine the correct reading of the text. That presents an interesting challenge to the judiciary, particularly in a law like the ACA. It's long, it's complex, it makes obscure references to multiple laws, and it's really boring to read, which I assume is why Scalia never bothered. But the court says that the judiciary is fully capable of understanding what the ACA does, and more important, why. So the court can interpret it all by itself. Abby Gluck wrote a nice piece in SCOTUS blog and essentially saying, the court says, we've got this. What was interesting was that contrary to some expectations, the court did not debate the canons of statutory interpretation. It didn't criticize others. It didn't do a Carl Llewellyn. That would have been a typical battle over which canon applies. But of course, you confront the problem that Posner wrote about, which is there is no principled hierarchy of canons of statutory interpretation. So maybe the court was wise to avoid that. I think there's another reason for avoiding this battle of canons. And that is that the court's approach here takes another slice off of Chevron's scope of application. And it expands somewhat, or recaptures, one might say, the court's scope of judicial review. Now, I'm not an administrative law expert, but I am certainly aware of some of the debate over what we call Chevron Step Zero. This is a threshold question of whether Chevron should apply at all. It obviously applies when Congress says agency has rulemaking authority to define terms, but then if so, you get to Chevron steps one and two. Is the text ambiguous? And if so, is the agency's interpretation reasonable in light of the overall statute? But most often, the statutes really don't speak expressly to that issue. And so we have disagreements between Scalia in particular and Breyer, and also Roberts to some extent. I mean, Scalia has argued for clear rules like defer to agencies that have formal rulemaking procedures, or defer to agencies when there's ambiguity in the statute. Breyer, on the other hand, who prides himself on administrative law expertise, thought that the clear, so-called clear Chevron rule, it was too simplistic to fit all these situations. So he argued for case-by-case determinations about whether the court should defer to agency interpretations. And you hear this kind of thinking, you can almost hear some old Breyer articles in the court's opinion in King. And that might not be surprising because Roberts himself has seemed a bit skeptical of relinquishing too much of the court's authority to the administrative agencies. And in King, he says that Congress could not have meant such a far-reaching decision to be in the hands of an agency. The meaning of the phrase exchange established by a state is too important to the central purpose and structure of the ACA to allow a mere agency to define it.
Right.
In fact, he writes, quote, "This is not a case for the IRS," close quote.
Right. So Bruce Huber, writing today on the Yale Journal of Regulation blog, referred to this as, quote, "the amplified major questions doctrine." Is this, do you think, going to be a major issue with regard to some of the regulatory issues that the court's going to be facing over the next few years?
It certainly could be. It could be the court's effort to take another step toward reining in Chevron. It could reflect a battle between Scalia on one hand and Roberts and Breyer on the other. And we still don't have a clear standard for determining what counts as a question of deep economic and political significance, or what is central to a statutory scheme. So fleshing out exactly when the court should take it upon itself to do an interpretation rather than deferring to the agency is, I think, remains to be done. Of course, the principle, if any, underlying Chevron itself remains pretty obscure too, so perhaps we're not losing anything.
Right. Yeah. So a couple of years ago, it was after Sibelius and NFIB, your colleague Abby Moncrief wrote a piece in the journal Chest, noting the court's refusal to recognize what she called healthcare exceptionalism. After King and the sort of the movement away from Chevron Zero, and noting Scalia's rather pithy SCOTUS care comment. Is there an argument that there is now some healthcare exceptionalism?
I don't see this as healthcare exceptionalism. I see this as part of a broader, effort at constructing doctrine in an era of more complicated legislation. I don't see that the ACA is an example of complicated legislation, but it's hardly the only one.
Talking of Justice Scalia, what did you think of his opinion? an opinion that ended, quote, "I dissent," not, quote, "I respectfully dissent." Amongst other things, do you think he was angry at the chief from turning Scalia's Sibelius dissent against him?
Well, I'm sure Roberts had a little grin on his face when he popped that in. in quoting Scalia's dissent to uphold the principle that Roberts was endorsing. Scalia's demonstrating less and less respect for his colleagues. If you'll note in today's same-sex marriage decision, he attacks the majority with adjectives that are personal rather than institutional. So this may be an indication of his frustration with the courts upholding something that he disagrees with.
Yeah, the fortune cookie footnote in the same-sex case was quite something, wasn't it?
Yes.
So when the Affordable Care Act was passed, it was hailed, and I think it was Tim Jost who said this, that it was the single most important piece of insurance regulation ever passed. Yesterday, the chief, in his opinion, said Congress passed the Affordable Care Act to improve health insurance markets, not to destroy them. So now we've had sort of two major cases from the court where the court has sort of rescued the private insurance model of healthcare financing. At the moment, therefore, it looks like it's pretty good to be a health insurer. Stock prices went up yesterday after the opinion was announced, as did the prices of healthcare providers. We know that Humana, Aetna, Cigna are all jockeying to get bigger I assume that the first merger gets through DOJ scrutiny, the second one doesn't. But I wonder whether, for all this good news for our friends in health insurance, maybe there's some tougher questions coming for them. We have high deductibles. We have plans that, some plans that amazingly omit hospitalization coverage. We have other cost-shifting, like coercive wellness plans. And we have thin, skinny, or narrow networks in many of the marketplace plans. There was an RWJ report that came out today or yesterday with three key findings. That the first, the narrowness or size of a network can be quantified. They found that 41% of silver plan networks in the marketplace, the ACA marketplace, are small or extra small. That consumers, while selecting these cheaper plans, have very, very little information about the characteristics of narrow networks at the time they make those choices. And, quote, well-functioning narrow networks will only survive if they will survive only if their characteristics are communicated more clearly to consumers and they are regulated to ensure adequacy. Are we going to move into a phase of much closer insurance regulation, do you think? And if so, will it be at the federal or state level?
Well, now you need a crystal ball to answer that. I mean, it is true that Robert's opinion in King was clearly focused more on the survival of the insurance industry than on the need for individuals for access to care. And it certainly recognized that the ACA needed all three of its legs to stand up and protect the industry. But indeed, I agree with Tim that this was indeed the most important form of insurance regulation. It expanded insurance regulation at the federal level in an unprecedented way. Now, that can be good news or that can be bad news. And at the moment, the insurance industry is, if not thriving, then very happy with the results of the ACA, and indeed, I'm sure that's why they submitted their own amicus briefs in support of the government on to protect their market. Their markets are increasing, and they've reconfigured their markets. But as you point out, this reconfiguration it may come at the cost of either benefit coverage or network coverage for individuals who are in these new health plans. And that's because the part of the ACA that we don't talk about quite as much were the less obvious efforts to try and achieve affordability. But affordability, if you only mean the price of a premium and ignore what the premium covers, not to mention deductibles and co-payments and sometimes co-insurance, becomes problematic for those who are buying it. So I think there is a great deal of challenge. I mean, you ask about regulation. Certainly there's a lot in the Act that encourages the states to ramp up their insurance regulation at the state level. That's going to be hard to do. I don't know that there's enough money in the grants to enable some of these very small departments of insurance to actually undertake the kind of regulatory review that is necessary. The departments have to cover auto insurance, which is their number one priority in most states, as well as all the other forms of insurance, and they're not all that expert at what goes on in the healthcare system. So federal regulation might prove to be more knowledgeable, but then you run into the problem of attacks on one size fits all government. Certainly, health insurers are seeking to consolidate in order not only to gain market share, but certainly to gain bargaining power over healthcare providers so that they can negotiate lower cost of care rates. And this probably will continue. I mean, you could have a wonderfully ironic situation in which we have single payer, but it's a private insurer. I mean, the large multi-state insurers may favor a federal marketplace and a federal regulatory system rather than multiple variables in each state's regulatory system.
I think not only may it get close to being a single payer, but I think it may be getting closer to a relatively vertically integrated piece as well. I mean, as we see these large insurers getting more interest in technology, in buying up the sort of clinics, the retail style clinics, and so on, I think those shifts are really interesting. And I think that's behind a lot of this merger activity that we're seeing.
Well, that could very well be true, but it also reflects what I think is a real shift in the conception of insurance in the field of healthcare. It's less and less like ordinary insurance in other lines of insurance. It's really a mechanism of financing care, and if you're financing care, you may as well control that care. So I can certainly understand the impetus to look at vertical integration rather than simply trying to negotiate a deal with third parties.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Well, while you're very successfully looking into the crystal ball that you own, let's end by speculating a little about the next few sort of legislative sessions, and even the 2016 elections. There are quite a few suggestions that the King Court, the majority, saved the GOP from the Pottery Barn rule. That, you know, if you break it, you own it. Congressional leaders promised continued attempts at repeal and replacement. And, of course, the GOP presidential field promises the same. What's your guess going forward? We've got another year and a half. I suspect that's not going to be long enough to answer Justice Scalia's question about whether the ACA has the enduring status of the Social Security Act or the Taft-Hartley Act. But I do wonder the extent to which the ACA will still be an issue in a year and a half, or is that just naive?
My crystal ball is a lot cloudier now. I think that it would be a nice analogy, the ACA and the Social Security Act. After all, the Supreme Court took some doctrinal risks in upholding the Social Security Act, and one could argue that it has done the same with the ACA. Nonetheless, I don't see an immediate reduction in political opposition. John Boehner keeps saying this law is broken, despite all evidence to the contrary. So I doubt that the attacks, but I think that the opponents are beginning to run out of arguments against the act. And in the scramble of the various representatives and senators who've attempted to come up with alternatives, nobody seems to agree with anyone else. So it seems unlikely that at least by the 2016 election, the GOP will be able to come up with an acceptable alternative that they can get 60 senators to agree on. Beyond that, who knows? The longer the law stays in place, as I think everyone recognizes, the harder it is to repeal. It's very difficult to take rights away from people, which is why, of course, if you don't want them, you try to prevent them from being established in the first place.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. For the second time this week, a very special thank you to Wendy Mariner for joining me. Thanks, Wendy.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
So we post our show notes at twill.com. That's TWIHL.com. And also at twill.com, you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry, NICOLASTERRY, on Twitter. And my dear friend Frank, even when he's traveling, can of course be found at Frank Pasquale on Twitter. Thank you for joining me for this second special episode in this intriguing week. Have a legally interesting but healthy weekend.